Good morning, everyone. We're going to get started, even though we don't have quite a quorum yet, but I'll announce when we do have one. So I'm going to call to order this hearing of the Health, Finance, and Policy Committee. Today is March 14th. It is Pi Day. If anyone doesn't realize, Pi Day, 3.14. And now a quorum is present. See that? I just delayed a little bit, and look what happened.
We were stuck in the elevator.
So, okay. So, anyway, we have no minutes to approve today. And I just want to announce as we get started here that because of a scheduling conflict, we've postponed House File 3992. Representative Liz Legard's bill, and our intention is to hear that on Tuesday coming up. So the first bill on the agenda then is House Bill 4605, Representative Bierman. And Representative Bierman is going to move that House Bill 4605 be laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. So Representative Bierman, to your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, committee members. Today I bring House Bill 4605. This is a roundtable RX bill for Roundtable RX. Roundtable RX, as most of you will remember, is the nonprofit designated by the Minnesota Board of Pharmacy to operate the Minnesota Medication Repository Program. Roundtable RX began operations in 2020 after the University of Minnesota College of Pharmacy students worked to pass legislation to allow such a program to exist in Minnesota. Since its founding, the program has received millions of dollars in medication donations from individuals and long-term care facilities. These donated medications are inspected by a pharmacist for safety and redistributed to Minnesota residents who would otherwise go without due to financial barriers. Roundtable RX has provided over 250 Minnesotans with over 666,570 days worth of medications since the end of February. Roundtable RX is seeking changes to Minnesota statute that would improve the program operations, expand access, and reduce administrative burden. Joining me today are Dr. Rowan Mann, one of the founders, and Dr. Rochelle Rockwell, the managing director in charge with Roundtable RX, to testify today and help to respond to questions. So we can go to those questions now. You have a little bit of go to the testifiers first. Dr. Rockwell will have some comments, and then we can go to member questions.
Okay, very good. Thank you, Representative Bierman. Welcome to the committee, Dr. Rockwell. Please just state your name for the record and go ahead.
My name is Rachel Rockwell. I am the pharmacist in charge and managing director at Roundtable RX. And then for those unfamiliar with the program, even though Representative Bierman gave a very good overview, Roundtable RX is the entity that operates the Minnesota Medication Repository Program under Minnesota Statute 151.555. We are under licensure and supervision by the Minnesota Board of Pharmacy. Our top priority is patient safety for our program and for operations. Donated products received by our program must be sealed in tamper-evident packaging and be unexpired. Of note, we do not accept controlled substances. Our inventory, as mentioned, is thoroughly inspected by a pharmacist before being redistributed to Minnesotans in need. Our program continues to grow year after year, with last year the amount of medications that we distributed increasing by nearly 100%. During this growth, we have identified areas of the current statute in need of change to improve program operations, increase impact, and enhance access. We are here today to review those proposed changes. All proposed changes have been made in collaboration with the executive director and legal counsel to the Minnesota Board of Pharmacy, and when applicable, with consultation from DHS. There are three buckets that our asks fall into. The first bucket is to expand the definition of eligible donor facilities. The second bucket is to allow medical assistants and Minnesota care recipients to access the program. And the third bucket is to reduce administrative burden. With our first bucket, we seek to expand the definition of an eligible donor to allow additional healthcare facility types to contribute to the program, such as residential treatment centers and correctional facilities. None of the safety measures around qualifying donations change. Rather, more types of healthcare facilities would be able to donate their unused quality medications. As demand for inventory increases, we need to increase our supply of donated quality medications to serve the Minnesotans that we serve in need. In the second bucket, we seek to expand access to our program for Minnesota's most vulnerable residents. We are asking for medical assistance and Minnesota care recipients to be eligible for our program during times of need. We have received multiple requests from our providers and clinic partners for this change, as they have patients who could benefit from the program but are currently excluded because of MA or Minnesota Care insurance status. We worked closely with DHS to make sure the wording and allowances were appropriate. Per DHS advisement, this population would not be allowed to be charged the handling fee or the dispensing fee. In bucket three, there are areas in current legislation that are duplicative and place administrative burden on the Board of Pharmacy, the repository program itself, and our partners without adding value or enhancing safety. As a reminder, these proposed changes were made in collaboration with the Executive Director and Legal Counsel to the Minnesota Board of Pharmacy. The changes are intended to reduce excess work while still maintaining all documentation and regulations needed for patient safety. These include reducing the number of times participants need to sign the exact same form, allowing forms to be completed electronically, allowing inventory records to be produced by the repository, so the Central Repository Roundtable RX, rather than being duplicated by our medication donors, requiring the repository to maintain all paperwork and make it available to the Board of Pharmacy upon request, and then removing the requirement to issue a program ID card to patients, changing where in the process safety checks by a pharmacist occur, which should be changed from the time of donation to the time of actual dispensing or distribution, and then finally allowing clinic and pharmacy partners to dispense over-the-counter medications from our program without a prescription, of course, only to qualifying patients. We hope you will support these proposed legislative changes. Ultimately, the proposed changes are intended to improve access to our program for Minnesotans in need while reducing medication waste and its impact on our environment. At this time, I will be glad to take questions.
Thank you very much. Representative Keel. Just before I go, I'm sorry, Representative Keel, before I go to you, let me just ask if there's anyone else in the room who wants to testify on the bill. Not seeing anybody. Okay, so we will go to questions and discussion. Go ahead, Representative Keel.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I've got to make you speaker by the end of the week, so. First of all, it's great to see you, young ladies. We met initially in a summertime setting where you came with an idea, and it looks like it's blossoming beyond that now. So we're helping people to seek the medicines that they need. Sounds like pretty much general medicines, so we're not talking about opioids or those types of things. So I appreciate that. I have concerns about making sure that we don't go too far too fast. However, it looks like it's working well, and thank you for your ideas. I want to encourage people. This came from the public. This didn't come from one of our brilliant ideas, the usage of being able to not throw away drugs. When I think about my elderly parents all of a sudden stopping something, and there it sits, and what do you do with it? You throw it away. This helps us to be able to use those drugs in an appropriate manner, and I like to see what's happening here. So it's exciting, and I thank you for pursuing this. I'm certainly anxious to hear other concerns of members. So thank you.
Thank you, Representative Keel. Well, I don't have anybody else on the list, and I think, Representative Bonner.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative Bierman. I'll try to be brief, but I think it's no surprise that I have been a strong supporter of this particular bill for some time. One of my main regrets this year is that my niece is no longer able to come and stump for this bill. She is now a fully registered pharmacist and out working in the world. I think this is an excellent program, and I have been really encouraged to see it grow over time and expand. And I think taking some additional steps to be able to scale this over time has been really, really beneficial and really heartening to watch. So I just wanted to say thank you for all of your efforts. I know it's taken a little bit of growing pains as you've gone along, but you've done it beautifully, and I really appreciate that.
Thank you, Representative Bonner. So any closing words, Representative Bierman?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, committee, for hearing the bill and all of the support from everyone. Really appreciate that, because, you know, this is a bill that when I first heard about it was in the first year I was up here, and I believe it was Representative Lippert had the bill to start. And it was just a bill that I was drawn to. I'd just been to a care center and witnessed how many drugs they throw away on a weekly basis, and I was horrified with the expense. So this is conserving that. It's saving money for people. And the thing about it is that if you look nationally, we are barely tapping the surface on what this program could become. But with the help of the committee and with the help and direction of these fine doctors who are leading it, the sky's the limit, and we could really make an impact and continue to grow with your support. So thank you very much, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative Bierman. Was there a okay, usually that was the final word on the bill, but if it's important, we can go to you, Representative Elkins. No?
I could follow up with the author.
All right. Thank you very much. And thank you for the very good explanation of the changes. So with that, House File 4605 is laid over for possible inclusion. Okay, next bill on the agenda is House File 1814, Representative Ryer. Bill that is not what it appears to be, since it's going to. So there is an author's amendment. Representative Ryer is going to move that House File 1814 be re-referred to the Committee on Taxes, and she wants to move the DE1-2 amendment. Is that right, Representative Ryer?
That's correct, Madam Chair.
Okay, so taking up the DE1-2 amendment to put the bill in the order in which the author would like it discussed. All in favor of adoption of the amendment, please. Representative Nadeau?
Yeah, just a question on the DE. Is on the time or not?
Well, I think we're going to adopt the DE, and then we'll have a lot of discussion on the DE.
I have a process question.
Okay.
So thank you, Madam Chair, and I'll be quick. I'm new here, so maybe I'm not quite, all that understanding. How can we take a bill, and is this normal? Does this happen all the time where we take a dental pilot project and all of a sudden we bring it forward and it's now a debt, it's a medical debt collection? Is that a normal process that we go through?
Well, Representative Doe, yes.
Okay.
It's called a vehicle bill.
Okay.
We do this often. And in committee, there isn't a germaneness rule, so it's not a problem that it's a bill for something else that is in our committee, which is why we selected this. So just since we're asking about the process of this bill is that this is actually a much more involved bill that is in the Commerce Committee, and the portions that are before this committee are being heard here today as in this DE. And the main bill will continue on its path. So this is the way to make sure that all the pieces get vetted in their proper committees. So these pieces that are before us, the intention is to lay them over and have them be in our omnibus bill.
Okay.
So that is the process.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Okay, sure. Okay, so with that, all in favor of adoption of the DE1-2, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
No.
Motion prevails, and the amendment is adopted. Representative Ryer, to your bill as amended.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and members, and thank you for explaining the process, because I was going to feel like I needed to do that. I appreciate that. So people need to be able to afford their lives. At the same time, healthcare providers need to be able to depend on people paying their bills. These two goals do not have to be in conflict. However, too many people are saddled with unmanageable medical debt. Our current laws do not support a successful resolution of this dilemma. That's why I'm pleased to present House File 1814 as amended, which adds a number of protections related to medical debt. And again, this is the medical debt section of the larger Minnesota Debt Fairness Act. Minnesotans are under a great deal of financial pressure from medical debt, as you can see from the letters in your packets and online. We also know that medical debt, consumer debt, and financial distress are strongly intertwined. A new study by the Peterson Center on Healthcare and KFF found that people with medical debt are more apt to have no rainy day fund, be overdrawn, have credit card debt, use payday loans, or be contacted by debt collection. We see disparities too. Black people and people with disabilities are more apt to have medical debt. Plus, there are direct health implications. Again, from Peterson KFF, 59% of people with medical debt have chosen not to get care due to cost. 59%. It's just 17% of people with no medical debt. And this affects population health. A study published in JAMA Network this month found that a higher share of the population with medical debt was associated with more days of poor physical and mental health, more years of life lost, and higher mortality rates for all cause and leading causes of death. They note that, I'll quote, "Our findings reinforce medical debt as a social determinant of health," end quote. And this study used data from 2,943 counties in the U.S. Minnesota has been taking steps to address medical debt issues. Last year, we passed legislation that codified and enhanced the steps hospitals must take to connect patients with resources that may help them avoid incurring medical debt in the first place. And we eliminated revenue recapture as a method for some privately owned hospitals to recoup medical debt. However, we need to do more to reduce the severe challenges that medical debt can cause. That's what this bill does. As we get ready to walk through the bill, I'd like to clarify a couple of points. Medical debt that is included in this legislation is for medically necessary services. It does not include, for example, cosmetic procedures performed in a clinic or by a doctor. It also does not include long-term care. And if a consumer pays their medical debt with a credit card, it will be treated as credit card debt, not medical debt for the purposes of, for example, credit score reporting. I want to thank the many stakeholders who have been working with us, many meetings, many hours, and more to come, to address concerns and find solutions. Thanks, too, to the agencies who have provided feedback and made it a better bill, including the Departments of Commerce, Revenue, Health, and Human Services, and, of course, House staff, Attorney General Ellison, the AGO team, and Senator Liz Bolden, my counterpart in the other body. There are many more conversations to come, and I'm committed to working with all stakeholders and colleagues. We're making good progress on the bill, working through concerns, while maintaining a focus on the well-being of the people of Minnesota. With that, I'd like to turn it over to Assistant Attorney General Bennett Hartz to talk about more of the specifics in the bill.
All right. Thank you, Representative Breyer. Before you do that, or before he comes down, I just want to say I misspoke one thing, and you can come down. That's fine. But I misspoke when I talked, when I told Representative Nadeau that we're going to lay it over. We're going to send it to taxes. But the portions that pertain to us, you may see in our omnibus bill. So just want to clarify that. So the motion before us today is to send this to taxes. So Bennett Hartz, welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and go ahead with your testimony.
Well, thank you, Chair Liebling, and thank you, members, for having me this morning to talk about this bill. My name is Bennett Hartz. I am an Assistant Attorney General in the Consumer Protection Division. Now, the Attorney General's office appears here today to support House File 1814, which are the medical provisions of the Minnesota Debt Fairness Act. This bill would help Minnesotans pay back their medical debt fairly and affordably without falling into poverty, bankruptcy, and further health crises in the process. The bill's current language reflects the authors and the Attorney General's productive and ongoing conversations with stakeholders on all sides of this bill, including advocates for providers, for patients, creditors, and debtors, and state agencies as well. Now, Representative Ryer has asked me to give an overview of the specific provisions for the committee, so that's what I'll do. Now, first, this bill would give patients protection against the worst hardships of medical debt. For example, it would allow patients to seek medically necessary care regardless of whether they have outstanding medical debt. It would also follow numerous other states and likely soon the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau nationwide in prohibiting the reporting of medical debt to the credit bureaus. Now, it would also reduce the interest on medical debt from its current cap at 8% to 4%. And it would also cut the Minnesota law that penalizes married couples, with the current state of laws that married couples are automatically liable for each other's medical debt. This is a provision that makes Minnesota an extreme outlier among other states and also results in very difficult decisions and financial situations, like spouses getting unwanted divorces to protect from financial hardship, as well as recent widows and widowers having to file bankruptcy on their spouse's, deceased spouse's medical debts. The bill would also require medical providers to make their collection practices available to the public and would enhance the ability for patients to challenge medical bills which they believe were wrongly coded by their provider or their insurance company. Now, the bill also creates some basic consumer rights for patients with medical debts. For example, it allows patients who successfully defend against a wrongful lawsuit for medical debt to request payment of their costs and attorney's fees if they win. It also includes protections against using, for example, false and misleading statements to induce someone to pay a medical debt, or using threats of illegal activity to induce someone to pay their medical debt. Now, both the patients themselves and the Attorney General's office would have the ability to enforce these rights, with patients having the ability to seek their damages as well as their costs and attorney's fees in cases where they are correct that there's been some illegal activity that they're trying to prevent. So the Debt Fairness Act seeks to make the medical debt collection process fair for everyone, so that this challenging but important function of the medical system can operate without letting patients and working families fall into poverty, and instead allows them to pay back their medical debts affordably and with dignity. Now, to that end, the Attorney General's office supports passage of House File 1814. Thank you all for your time and for your attention to this critical bill.
Thank you very much. And so we'll go to the next testifier, and I hope you'll be around for questions. Next is Walt Myers. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name and go ahead and give us your testimony.
Good morning, Madam Chair and members of the committee. Thank you for hearing my story. My name is Walt Myers, and I'm from Lakeville. I'm a lifelong resident of Minnesota and a father of three. I'm an Army veteran and a cancer survivor, and I'm also a volunteer at Cancer Legal Care. My wife, Sue, battled breast cancer for 23 and a half years. In January of 2019, we were informed by her oncologist that Sue's cancer had metastasized to her liver. And while treatment options available, she didn't want, her doctor said that she didn't expect any of them to do much good. Sue immediately told her doctors that she was done, that she didn't want any more chemotherapy. So after 23 and a half years, my wife became a hospice patient. It was her wish to stay in her home, or in our home, for as long as possible. And the hospital put us in contact with an in-home hospice team that provided Sue with exceptional care for the last 2 months of her life. During that time, I began to receive explanation of benefits, or EOBs, from the insurance company. The EOBs were usually many pages long, explaining the services that had been provided. And at first I tried to reconcile them, but I couldn't. It was just overwhelming. On the first page of each ELB was printed, this is not a bill. So I just ended up making a stack of them on my desk. Shortly after Sue's passing, the EOBs turned into actual bills, sometimes for thousands or even tens of thousands of dollars. I couldn't understand what was happening because the charges far exceeded what my plan said I should owe. I was confronted with what was becoming a significant medical debt that I didn't understand and I had no idea what to do about. At first, I tried dealing with the bills myself and I called people who I thought might be able to help me. Most of them were sympathetic, but no one really knew what to do. Fortunately, I somehow remembered a comment a social worker made to us, during one of Sue's treatments at the cancer center. And she told us that if you ever need legal help, there's this organization called Cancer Legal Care that provides free legal services to cancer patients in Minnesota. And I remember that thinking to myself at that time, I said, well, why would I ever need something like that? So I called them and explained what was happening, Cancer Legal Care, and they put me in contact with their insurance expert. And with the help of my former employer, we found a way to contest the bills. After a few stressful weeks of waiting, we got a response back from the insurance company. The entire amount had been forgiven, all of it, $135,000. A surprise out-of-network medical debt was gone. I can only imagine what my life would be like now if I hadn't remembered that seemingly random comment made by the social worker that day. I might still be making monthly payments to a six-figure medical debt that I didn't actually owe. So I suppose no one would be surprised if I said that I wholeheartedly support the effort to ban the transfer of medical debt to a patient's spouse. And I would respectfully encourage the members of the committee to do the same. The elimination of Sue's medical debt was a life-changing moment for me, and eliminating spousal debt could have an equally life-changing effect on many Minnesotans. Please pass this bill and make it a reality in Minnesota. I believe it's the right thing to do. Thank you very much.
Thank you for your testimony. Mary Krinke? Welcome to the committee.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, for the record, my name is Mary Krinke, and I'm with the Minnesota Hospital Association. I want to start out and just say that we've had several really good meetings with Representative Ryer, and we have another one tomorrow morning at 8 a.m., and we are continuing to work to try to scope this bill a little bit. We hope that legislators can find the right balance between how to help low-income Minnesotans better afford their health care services and yet ensure that our nonprofit hospitals and health care systems can get paid for the services that they have provided in order to help keep those services available for everyone. I do want to note that the Commonwealth Fund says that Minnesota, and I think we should be proud of this, says that we have the lowest amount of medical debt in the country at 2.4% of our population, compared to my home state of West Virginia, which has the worst at 24% of their residents have medical debt. We recognize that no one really chooses to have medical debt. Life happens, bad things happen, and many people just can't help the circumstances that they find themselves in. This is a growing problem as more and more people have high deductible health plans. Under the current bill, there would be financial challenges for hospitals and health systems. And some of it is because there are multiple provisions that work together, and we're hoping that maybe we can address some of those. We've discussed a couple ideas with Representative Ryer, some she might like better than others. One is to have some type of income cap, maybe at 400% of the federal poverty limit. The other idea we're kind of noodling around is, could hospitals and health plans offer payment plans to individuals for a period of time without any interest or referring to credit score companies, that we would work with individuals to help them pay off a portion of their medical bill? I think this is particularly interesting in that the Kaiser Family Foundation has said that 47% of medical debt is less than $2,000. So we really can work with a lot of these people to help them pay off their medical debts. I just also want to make a plug, and this is my closing comment, for a bill by Representative Biermans. It's House File 3840 that would shift a portion of collecting copays and deductibles to the health plans. Right now, providers are stuck with doing this for everyone. We really want to be caregivers and not bill collectors. And that bill would set it up so that the health plans are responsible for collecting the copays and deductibles for emergency rooms and for ambulance services. Not all inpatient services, not clinic appointments, but for ambulances and for emergency rooms. And we think that is a better balance to have somebody else collecting some of these bills instead of just providers. Thank you, Madam Chair. And Representative Ryer, I'll see you at 8 a.m. tomorrow morning.
All right, thank you for your testimony. Next we have Dana Bacon. Welcome to the committee.
Hi, good morning, Madam Chair, members. I'm Dana Bacon. I'm from Rosemount, and I'm here as Senior Director of State Government Affairs for the Leukemia and Lymphoma Society. I'm here today to support Rep. Ryer's bill as amended. You should have a letter in your packet signed by my organization as well as, and forgive me for looking, I haven't memorized this long list, the ALS Association, the American Cancer Society, Cancer Action Network, the ARC of Minnesota, Cancer Legal Care, thank you, Mr. Ryer, Minnesota Association of Community Health Centers, Minnesota Budget Project, Minnesota Nurses Association, National Kidney Foundation, and National Multiple Sclerosis Society. These are just some of the groups who hope you will support this legislation today. It's no secret that medical debt causes serious economic, emotional, and physical harm. Last year, LLS joined ACS-CAN and RIP Medical Debt in surveying 2,600 Americans on this topic because it's something we care about for the patients we serve. Nearly half of those surveyed said they'd experienced medical debt personally. The top word that described their experience was trapped by medical debt. Of those people, about 40% said they felt embarrassed or ashamed of their debt, which might be some explanation for why it's so hard for the public to come forward and say, here's what I've experienced. Similar number of people said they delayed or skipped care because they feared they might fall further into debt. So with all this in mind, it's no secret that we need better protections for Minnesotans facing these challenges. And we believe Representative Ryer's legislation strikes the right balance to help. We strongly support lowering interest rates on medical debt. We strongly support keeping medical debt out of credit scores. It's nothing people choose for themselves, and people need fair credit scores to be able to participate in the basic aspects of our economy. We also support preventing medical systems from blocking care for patients when they carry an outstanding debt. Patients aren't asking for a free pass. They're asking for a fair shot. I'd want to say that again. We don't want a free pass. We want a fair shot. I want to thank Rep. Ryer, Governor Walz, and Attorney General Ellison for their work on this issue, and I hope you will join them in moving this bill forward this session. Thanks for your time.
Thank you for your testimony. Is there anyone else who wants to testify on the bill? All right, not seeing anyone, so with that we can have some discussion. And since no one's name is on the list yet, I'll just say a couple of things. One, I first of all appreciate that Representative Ryer, as always, is working hard to find the best possible path through this really complicated and very fraught issue. And I'm so glad that the bill is here, and for everyone who's working on it, thank you, Representative Ryer. Mary Krinke's testimony about, you know, some of her suggestions, to me it's a little shocking that hospitals aren't already giving payment plans to people, especially if somebody has a small amount of debt. I mean, I think some of them probably are. And I don't usually give my own anecdotes here in committee, but it did make me think of one, and that was where a constituent contacted me about a debt to Mayo Clinic. Her husband had had an illness, a very expensive illness, and had ultimately passed away. And this low-income widow was panicked because of the debt that she was expected to pay. And I'll never forget that. This is a good Mayo Clinic story, because Mayo Clinic did work with her and ultimately forgave her debt. And so that was a great thing. But again, here's a woman who had to contact her legislator, who then put her in contact, you know, back with Mayo to try to get them to focus on her issue, and they ultimately did. But good grief, this is happening to people all the time. And they don't think of contacting their legislators, I think, a lot of the time. Anyway, I just wanted to make those initial comments. And while I was doing that, lo and behold, we have other people on the list. So, Representative Nadeau.
You inspired me, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative Ryer. I have just one quick question and then maybe a couple of smaller ones. Is this an AGO bill? Like last year we had this merger bill and it was really an attorney general bill. Is this an attorney general bill, or is this your thing? Okay.
Representative Ryer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative Nadeau. I want to explain that more than just a nod. It is a spontaneous coming together of mutual agreement around needs that needed to happen, so we decided to partner up.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Nadeau.
Yes, I do hope, and I was actually super happy to see Mary Krinke and you working together on this. I think there's some things that we can do. I do want to make sure that, you know, this bill, there's a lot of providers that need protection as well. And so I'm going to start in this medical necessity, medical necessary area. You know, you go through here and you define, you know, what this is. And I know that in your opening comments, you said that, you know, cosmetic surgery would not be medically necessary, but, as I look through this list, starting at, you know, line 1.19 to 2.8, you know, there's not a lot in here that could be excluded. And maybe that's the intent, but for example, I'm going to use, because this bill might be coming in front of us too, what about a prosthetic? So all of a sudden, if a prosthetic, if that's part of a medical necessary thing, and there's a copay, there's a part of this bill that's required from the patient, and they don't pay it. Let's just say they don't pay it. Would the provider here be able to withhold payment from the supplier of that prosthetic?
Representative Ryer.
Your provider's not getting paid.
Representative Nadeau.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Representative Ryer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I am going to invite the Assistant Attorney General to come back. And in the meantime, I'll say that goes into a whole separate business contract agreement. So I think that is outside the scope of this bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Yeah.
Representative Nadeau, I agree that it's outside the scope of the bill. Ultimately, the provider has the same remedy against the patient that any other party that's owed money does, which is that they can bill them, they can bring them to court, get a judgment against them, and then, you know, seek repayment of their debt through the judicial process the way any other creditor could.
Representative Nadeau.
But doesn't this bill preclude that?
Mr. Hartz.
Chair Liebling, Representative Nadeau, precludes taking a person to court for a repayment of a medical debt? No.
Representative Nadeau.
Yeah, thank you. And I'm sorry, maybe I'm not understanding this. So if someone doesn't pay their medical bills, the provider can't try to collect the debt. They can't use revenue recapture under this bill. They can't collect that debt. Is that Is that untrue?
Chair,
Mr. Hartz.
Chair Liebling, Representative Nadeau, that is untrue, yes. This bill creates restrictions about the use of on credit reporting, about the acceptable level of interest that's chargeable, and about withholding necessary care from the patient going forward, but it does not preclude the ability to take normal means of collection, phone calls, bills, and then eventually, you know, selling to a third-party debt buyer, hiring a debt collector, going to court, getting a judgment, garnishing, levying bank accounts. All of the traditional avenues of collection are available to medical providers.
Final follow-up. Representative Nadeau, we have a couple other people on the list. Go ahead.
With the exception of revenue recapture.
Chair Liebling.
Mr. Hartz.
Representative Nadeau, I don't believe that revenue recapture would be available under existing law to, for example, a provider of a prosthetic. From my understanding of the law that was enacted in 2023, revenue recapture is available, and Representative Ryer, this was your bill, so you can correct me if I'm wrong, but revenue recapture was made only available to emergency ambulance services in the medical context.
Okay. And you know, it might be worth sort of maybe for the audience and just as a bit of a refresher, kind of reminding people what revenue recapture is. Revenue recapture is not the same thing as, you know, it's a euphemism for basically going through government to get debts paid. Mm-hmm. It's a certain way of getting to be able to garnish people's payments that are coming from the state. It's not the way that most creditors are going to go after debt. It's a very special, limited way for some. And Mr. Hartz, if you want to expound on that.
Yes, Chair Liebling, thank you. That's a good point of clarification. I can see, I think, where we're getting disconnected here. Revenue recapture is the ability for the state to keep a portion or all of a person's tax refund, primarily. You know, I think it applies to other cash payments that come through the state, but the primary one is a person's tax refund. The state can, for example, with taxes, if somebody owes, you know, $5,000 in back taxes to the Department of Revenue, and they are going to get a tax refund of $3,000, the Department of Revenue can do a revenue recapture and keep that $3,000 and send them a letter that says, sorry, no refund for you this year. We've applied that to your outstanding balance. So there's a provision in the revenue recapture statute that used to let certain subsets of medical providers in the state do that too. And keep in mind, this is not going through the judicial process. So there's no court oversight. There's no judgment. They just could apply to the state and say, we have an outstanding bill. Take a person's tax refund and send it to us. That bill was narrowed last year to only, in the medical context, to only apply to emergency ambulance services. So emergency ambulance services are able to still use that revenue recapture means of getting their bills paid, but other medical providers are not. The standard process that a creditor takes to collect a bill, sell it downstream through the debt buying market, bring a patient to court, get a judgment, all of that is fully available to providers just as it would be to any other creditor.
Just one thought.
Right, and staff is saying that municipal hospitals can also use it.
Thank you.
So just to be utterly clear. So I think that was what Mary Cranky wanted to say.
I said one more quickly.
Well.
Since we have it.
Okay,
here.
The other two people. Go ahead, Representative Nadeau.
And this wouldn't have anything to do with the state recovery for MA patients. This wouldn't touch the estate recovery statutes that allow the state to claw back assets from people to cover MA payments and the federal requirements to go along with that.
That's Chair Liebling, Representative, that's correct. When a person dies, their estate basically becomes like an avatar for the deceased person, and any ability that you have to collect money from that person while they were alive becomes an ability to get paid by their estate. What we have in Minnesota is a law that says, and it's about one paragraph, you can see it modified in this bill. It says essentially spouses are not liable for each other's debts. Their debts can be divvied out in a family court in a divorce proceeding, but otherwise spouses are not liable for each other's debts, except for medical debts. And so this would essentially line item that out so that medical debt does not get that special treatment under statute. The remedies against a person's estate would remain exactly as they are with all other kinds of debts.
All right.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Murphy and then Keel.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative Ryer. I just want to make a comment. You know, I had a significant issue when I was younger with our son. And to go back to what Representative Liebling talked about, too, you know, hospitals are, providers are interested in working with you, too. And this product doesn't necessarily, this bill doesn't necessarily eliminate debt. It just transfers it. Hospitals need to make a profit to stay in business. And so they have bills to pay, and to be solvent, they need to be profitable. I just want to kind of encourage you to work with, to look at working with the providers, because the providers are the ones that really can help execute this program a lot better than if we mandate it from above. And they are doing a good job. In my case, the Mayo Clinic, it was a large, my son had brain surgery, it was a big time deal. And it was a large expense, and they worked it out. We worked it out, and I paid the bill. And that's the important part, I think, is that if you want to pay the bill, if you want to do your part, too, you can. This makes it really easier for somebody to say, you know what, I think I'm going to try to get out of this debt, and it's somebody else's problem. And so anyway, I just want to tell my story about it, so thank you.
Thank you. Representative Keel.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'll try and be quick. I want to reinforce the message that Representative Murphy said. I've noticed that as I deal with more family debt, different health care issues, whether it's elderly or whatever, the hospital has been very, my critical access hospital has been very open and workable with what needs to be done. Hey, did you know you could do this? Here's this. There really is some services around here, and I've been all over the place. I've been to Mayo, St. Cloud, and I'm seeing different assists, but I really think we need to listen to our hospitals and what they have to say about how they're doing things. But I do know there are challenges, too. I get phone calls all the time about, especially when people are deceased. We own the house. Half of it's going to the county because of the expenses, and but that is the reality of their income and how they're dealing with life. So it's complicated. It's heartbreaking, and but we want to make sure that people can have health care when they need it. So I appreciate the work that you're doing with our hospital associations, because our critical access hospitals are really in trouble, and you know, considering the both the emergency room costs and the EMT costs are very important for us to have those services. So thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair.
All right. Final word, Representative Ryer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, members. I appreciate the feedback. I do want to go back to the first sentence I said. First two sentences, people need to be able to afford their lives. At the same time, healthcare providers need to be able to depend on people paying their bills. And that's why this has been a collaborative process with hospitals, with clinic groups, with specialty groups, with people, providers across the system, to be able to make sure that we are doing something in the interest of all Minnesotans, including the people who provide care and the people who are suffering and experiencing hardship because of the medical bills that they in no way sought and wish to have. So I appreciate the support, and thank you for the time today.
All right, so with that, Representative Ryer renews her motion that House File 1814 as amended be re-referred to the Committee on Taxes. All in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
No.
Motion prevails, and the bill is on its way to Texas. Thank you, Representative Ryer. And she's going to stay there because the next one is hers as well.
I don't get to get my steps today going back and forth.
So, okay, next is House Bill 4758. And Representative Ryer's motion is for 4758 to be laid over for possible inclusion in an omnibus. And there are no amendments that I see, so to your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. House File 4758 is offered to help legal services advocates and low-income clients obtain medical records for Social Security disability appeals. Statute changes in 2012 allowed legal aid and other organizations that assist low-income clients to receive records for Social Security disability appeals without charge. However, the wording of the bill language is confusing. Medical records copying services, which often bill for these records for other purposes, are unclear of the Minnesota standard. This isn't surprising because the record copying services most large medical networks in Minnesota use are located out of state and contend with up to 50 different billing rules. House File 4758 does not change the standards in statute. It simply rearranges and clarifies the languages, the language so the record copying services know what to charge. And it lays out more clearly exactly what documentation is needed for legal services attorneys and advocates to qualify for free records. These changes will alleviate some of the confusion and cut back on the hours attorneys and advocates spend to obtain the records. And most importantly, they'll help the clients receive the assistance they need for their Social Security appeals in a timely way. Ms. Ellen Smart is here today to address any questions that we may have. Ms. Smart is from Minnesota Legal Aid.
All right. Thank you, Representative Ryer. So is there anyone else in the room who wants to testify on the bill? Not seeing anyone. So, and I'm not really seeing any questions from the committee. So I think your first word may be your final word, Representative Ryer. And I think we can... I think we're all set. So with that, the bill is laid over for possible inclusion in an omnibus. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
All right, the next couple of bills are mine, and they are actually agency bills. So I'm going to just stay here and let the agencies come and tell us about their bills. So the first one is 4801. MNSURE reporting requirements. Welcome to the committee. Please go ahead and introduce yourself and tell us about my bill, your bill. Oh, I'm sorry. I did not move the bill. I have to do that to bring it before the committee. So my motion is that House File 4801 be laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus. Go ahead.
Great. Thank you, Madam Chair, members of committee. My name is Erica Helvick Anderson, and I'm the Senior Director of Public Affairs for MNSURE. MNSURE has a few proposals in this bill that would make minor changes to internal processes and requirements for MNSURE. For example, this bill would change the timing of our annual report and preliminary budget, while also changing quarterly interagency reporting to an annual reporting going forward. I can go into more details on exactly what those proposals do. Each year, MNSURE submits its annual report to the legislature on January 15th. This report provides the legislature and public with an overview of not only MNSURE's operations, but also insight into its open enrollment period, which typically runs from November 1st through January 15th in any given year. MNSURE also reports its preliminary three-year budget to the legislature on March 15th of each year. This proposal will change the due date for MNSURE's annual report to the legislature from January 15th of each year to March 31st of each year. Additionally, this bill will change the due date for MNSURE's preliminary budget from March 15th to March 31st of each year. These changes would allow MNSURE to continue to provide an annual update on operations while also allowing MNSURE to include a more robust analysis of the entire previous plan year's activities, as well as a full accounting of the open enrollment period. This change would also mean that the annual report and preliminary budget are submitted to legislature at the same time. This proposal would also streamline our interagency reporting requirements to the legislature. MNCHR is required to submit quarterly reports to legislature on its interagency agreements, while other agencies report yearly on those same interagency agreements. This proposal would align MNCHR's reporting requirements, and instead of reporting quarterly, MNCHR would submit the interagency agreements report once per year, as other agencies do. Madam Chair, members of the committee, open to questions.
All right, thank you. Is there anyone in the room who wants to testify on the bill? Not seeing anybody. Are there questions, discussion to the bill? Representative Elkins.
Thank you, Madam Chair. More of a comment than a question. I've been on the appointed to the MNCHR LCC Oversight Committee for the last 4 years. It has never once met because the Senate will not appoint its members. So we're doing a lot of work here and to provide oversight, and the oversight isn't being protected because the lesser body doesn't want to.
Okay, I'm not sure if there's any response required to that, but thank you, Representative Elkins. Other discussion? Representative Quam.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And, this March tends to be a pretty packed time for the legislature. And if you're transitioning from quarterly to just an annually, I would hope, and I think it'd be nice for the working and the legislature together with the agencies if you kept the one quarterly as a summary just before. You see what I'm saying? You've got an annual. So you do the three quarterlies on that quarterly point, so the legislature has an opportunity to get a sort of preliminary upfront information and help us to get staged and be closer to what we might need to do, before getting it. We get all this stuff thrown on us, and we're meeting extra meetings till midnight, etc. And I think if we got some of this information and a heads up at a time where we can maybe take a breath, sit down and review it and digest it, that might be good for the process. It's just a thought. And thank you, Madam Chair.
Okay. I'll go ahead and respond. Ms. Helvick Anderson, right?
Thank you. Yes. Madam Chair, members of the committee. So there's two reports that are in this. The quarterly report that we're talking, moving from quarterly to annually, would be under the interagency agreement statute, and that gets reported on October 15th. So then the other one, so that's the interagency reports. I think maybe the one that you're more interested in is that quarterly, or is the annual report that kind of goes over open enrollment and those analysis, and that has been historically done on January 15th, and we're looking to move it to March 15th. And I know we've already had some conversations with the chair. Is that March 31st the right timing for you all with the legislature? So open to maybe let's touch base on that if there's a different date that would work for the legislature as well. But my team just wants more time to kind of analyze and give you guys also better information than just the high numbers that we can pull in time.
Right. And Ms. Helvick Anderson, I think that part of the issue on that, right, from your explanation, is when the enrollment period closes so that you've actually got the data and able to digest it, present it. And that's not really easily movable. So I think that was kind of the impetus for this, right?
Yeah, Madam Chair, members of the committee, that's correct. So open enrollment closes for the full time period on January 15th. So historically, we've been only able to pull the data from people who start their plan year on the January 1st. So this will be able to pull it all the way through the February 1st start part of the period of the open enrollment, and then also give us time to analyze it. So there's a little bit of a push-pull, but maybe, maybe there's like a high number one we could submit that might be of interest, or we can chat about that.
Okay, thank you. And I don't see any other questions. Just my editorial comment of this, too, is just that these interagency agreements and transfers, I mean, they were put in at one time. I must say, I don't find them very helpful, and I was not sorry to see this being reduced at least to what other agencies have to do, and I personally would like to get rid of them altogether. So to me, this is just fine. So, and with that, House File 4801 is laid over for possible inclusion. Thank you.
Thank you.
Next is House File 4802, which is also my bill, and it's actually, this is the MDH bill, and the MDH policy bill. And so the motion is that House File 4802 will be laid over for, to be laid over for possible inclusion in an omnibus, and there is an author's amendment from the department to make what I think are some technical corrections to that. And do you want to just, before we adopt the amendment, maybe just tell us, is it just, it's technical corrections, am I correct on that? Yes, okay, so I move adoption of the A1 amendment, and then we'll have the bill in the form in which it can be discussed. So all in favor of adoption of the A1, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. The amendment is adopted. So to the bill as amended, and who's going to talk here? Ms. Backstrom.
Good welcome. Morning, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Carol Backstrom, and I am an assistant commissioner at the Department of Health. I oversee the Health Systems Bureau. I'm going to be here to just kind of provide a very high-level walkthrough of the department's policy bill this year. There are several sections, and I think, you know, in general, this bill could be described as a housekeeping bill, meaning just mostly conforming changes, but there are also some minor policy changes. So I'm going to just start with the walkthrough. Section 1 relates to administrative simplification public review. This proposal updates the current process for submitting comments via email for submission of comments, which is simpler, more flexible, and more effective method for achieving communication and accountability with our regulated industries or our regulated entities. Section 2 clarifies the One Health Antimicrobial Stewardship Collaborative Director status. This proposal clarifies that the director for the One Health Antimicrobial Stewardship Collaborative is a civil servant and not an appointed position. Section 3 relates to health occupation license updates. As you may know, the Department of Health regulates and registers several health professions, including body art and mortuary science and funeral establishments. This proposal relates to body art applicants and clarifies that these body art applicants, that fees are non-refundable. This proposal also clarifies that a provisional body art establishment will require a new provisional license if they wish to relocate. Sections 4 through 11 relate to case mix. As you may know, case mix is a system that classifies residents into distinct groups based on the resident's condition and the care the resident is receiving at the time of the assessment. This essentially determines the daily rate that the facility charges for the resident's care. It's an example of how MDH and DHS works together. This is and can be described as a federal conformity issue. CMS, our federal overseers, has updated and revised their payment system requiring language change, requiring a language change in our Minnesota statutes related to the categorization of nursing home Medicaid and private pay residents for the calculation of payment. These changes will ensure that nursing home providers are appropriately reimbursed for the care and services that they provide to residents. Again, federal conformity. Section 12 relates to the International Medical Graduate Program. This is a program that we run through our Office of Rural Health and Primary Care. This proposal expands for refugees who have temporary status from Afghanistan and the Ukraine to seek guidance and support for preparing to use their medical background to serve communities in Minnesota. Section 13 relates to Chapter 16C, and it's a waiver request for procurement of contractors who conduct our trauma hospital designation. As you may know, Chapter 16C regulates state contracts. but the potential contractor market for our work in state trauma hospital designation is very limited based on experience and availability. These contractors are agreeing to work for very little pay at the expense of their clinical practices because they are committed to the public policy benefits of the state trauma system. They are not professional contractors who know how to navigate the state contracting bureaucracy, especially when some requirements do not pertain to the work. So this is seeking to waive our 16C process for this specific contract. Moving on, we have sections 14 and 15, which relates to nursing home informal appeals. And this, again, is a federal conformity issue. Minnesota nursing homes are governed under both state statute and federal regulations. The department is responsible for following both sets of laws when surveying and implementing enforcement against nursing homes in the state. This language will conform the state processes to the federal regulations and provides more clarity for nursing home administrators regarding the informal dispute process. Sections 16 through 22 have to do with assisted living and home care licensure updates. As you may know, the legislature passed assisted living licensure in 2019, which set consistent and clear expectations for providers and created more protections for people living in assisted living establishments. Since implementation in August of 2021, we have continued to engage stakeholders in providing some more clarity. So these licensure updates primarily provide clarifications as it relates to the assisted living licensure chapter, as well as the home care chapter, which is where largely those home care provisions moved into a separate chapter of law for assisted living specifically. I'm happy to go through those specific changes if you'd like. Section 27 is the Office of Medical Cannabis. As you know, with the newly established Office of Medical Cannabis, we will be moving over to the Office of Cannabis Management in 2025. These changes in the bill are preparing for that process and includes updating the process for veteran enrollment and changes to the determination of a qualifying medical condition from annually to every 3 years. And these are generally chronic conditions. And then the final section is just a repealer having to do with ST elevation, myocardial infarctions, or the most serious of heart attacks. And this is how this information is currently reported. STEMI is the most serious type of heart attack, often involving complete blockage of a coronary artery. This data collection around STEMI events is pretty variable, highly variable in the state. And so therefore, absence of federal mandate or a new statewide approach to STEMI care and data collection, we are unable to meet the current statute. So with that, Madam Chair, I'm happy to answer any questions, and I'm also pleased that we have a lot of staff from the Department of Health here today who are the subject matter experts and all of which I described today.
All right. Thank you for that overview here and quick run through. Representative, first let me ask if there's anyone else who wants to testify on the bill. Okay. So we will go to questions and comments. Representative Nadeau.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I probably missed this, but when you were talking about Section 3, I heard art therapists. What I didn't hear was the interpretive services. And I don't know if I missed something. Did you talk about that and I missed it?
I believe, and correct me if
Ms.
I'm wrong.
Ms. Backstrom.
Oh, I'm sorry, Madam Chair, Representative Nadeau. If I'm not mistaken, I think we were trying to provide examples of the types of health professions that we regulate. So there's no actual changes to interpretive services. It's just an example of the types of health professions that we regulate.
Thank you.
So Representative Nadeau is raising a good point, and I was a little confused, too, as I was following along here in the bill. And I wonder if there's sort of an error here. So if you go to line 2.9, there's the it's Interpreter Services Quality Initiative. So I think this is where Representative Nadeau is talking about. So that's in there, and I don't see any change to it. And then as you were talking, Ms. Backstrom, you mentioned something about the when you were talking about the. I'm sorry. the, okay, that's part of the, okay. So it's being pointed out to me, so there's a change on line 3.5 and 3.6 about the fees. Okay, that's in the interpreter roster. But when we got there, I thought you were talking about the tattoo art people. And there, and you were talking about another issue with that that I don't see in the bill. So are we out of phase here?
Madam Chair, this may have been my own shortening of my notes. So let me turn it over to Lisa Timmy.
Okay. Please introduce yourself for the record.
Hi, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I'm Lisa Timian, I direct government relations at the Minnesota Department of Health. And, yeah, this was just in our effort to just consolidate the different pieces that are in this. This is actually at Section 23 at line 20.29. You can see tattoo technician language. Really, the purpose of this change overall is just to clarify that these fees submitted to us are non-refundable and to direct folks who do wish to appeal to an online process of how that works.
Okay, thank you. That is very helpful because I recall that I had read about that or that you talked to me about that, and then as we were going through and I was trying to follow in the bill and did not see it where it was being discussed. So thank you. That is helpful. Okay, any other questions? All right, and I should just say here that while you have in here some provisions, minor provisions relating to the Office of Medical Cannabis, there is a, as you know, a larger cannabis-related bill that is moving, and that bill will be coming to this committee. And I just want to flag for members that my intention would be, I don't think I've talked to you about this either, but to put those provisions onto that other bill and not carry them in this committee's omnibus bill just for, you know, ease of having everything together, because I believe there will be other, possibly other Office of Cannabis items in that bill. So we can discuss that, but that is kind of my intention with this. Representative Quam.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I want to applaud you on that idea, because what I hear from people, the public, is you've got all this stuff together and here and there. And when you can concentrate in a bill, an area, it makes it so much easier for the public to understand. So I just wanted to give you kudos to have done it once in my life.
Oh, my goodness. Well, thanks. But Representative Quam, it's not the only time. So, you know, don't sell yourself short here. Okay. And, you know, another issue like that, too, is that there are licensing, the 144G home care licensing provisions are also being carried in other places, and there may be some attempt to try to bring those together as well, just so that, to Representative Quam's point, you know, that everybody can look at these all in one batch and not have them scattered across different bills. So we're working on that as well. Okay, any other discussion to this very exciting bill? I know the department likes to say it's boring. We always find it very exciting. So with that, House File 4802 as amended is laid over for possible inclusion. And with that, although we had another bill scheduled for today, we had to move that one, so we're giving you some of your time back, and we will meet, today is Thursday, so we're going to meet next week. And yes, we're going to meet Tuesday at 10:30 right here. Stay tuned. We are adjourned.